welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 31st, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduneau, and from the front page of today's Gazette, under the heading Cancer in Iowa, Iowa changing the way it looks for cancer clusters. Community cluster probes have not been successful, a study notes, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette in Hudson. 13 teachers with breast cancer from a small northeast Iowa school district seemed more than unlucky. It seemed suspicious. As Diane Anderson, a retired junior high English teacher at the Hudson Community School District, was doing chemotherapy to fight triple-negative metaplastic breast cancer in 2021, she talked with a former colleague who also had breast cancer. They started counting up current and former Hudson staff with breast cancer and eventually reached 13. "I know cancer is common, unfortunately," said Anderson, 68, of Cedar Falls, "but this is a really small district. I was teaching with a staff of about 65 people. It kind of started scaring me." Anderson asked the Iowa Cancer Registry at the University of Iowa to investigate whether the Hudson School District was a cancer cluster, defined as a greater than expected number of cancer cases among a group of people in a defined geographic area, such as a neighborhood, town, or workplace, over a period of time. The Hudson probe is one of 150 cluster investigations the registry has done since 1994. Only one of those investigations ended with a confirmed cancer cluster, and in that case, researchers couldn't find anything in the environment that caused the cancer. That doesn't necessarily mean toxic exposures didn't cause cancer, but to have a true finding, you'd have to rule out the role of chance, said Charles Lynch, who led the registry from 1990 to 2020, before he retired. With small numbers, you need to have huge differences between the target area and your control area. The likelihood of that happening was very rare. The Cancer Registry is expanding the way staff investigate whether the environment, air, water, chemicals in a workplace, might be causing cancer. In a reversal of the traditional process, public health researchers will start with a location with known contamination and see if people are sick nearby. Instead of relying on concerned citizens to come to us, can we start to systematically look for potential clusters of cancer beyond what we would expect and then work with different groups to say, is there something in that community? Said Mary Charlton, a UI epidemiology professor and registry director. Travis Julifs was a high school senior at Mid Prairie High School when he started getting headaches. "In 1996, 18, young and dumb, my focus was how quickly can I get back on the football team," said Julifs, 45, who now lives in Texas. "I'm not sure at that age you understand your mortality." Doctors at the UI hospitals and clinics determined Julifs had a brain tumor, pilocytic astrocytoma, that was cancerous but not malignant. Still, the tumor had to come out, and brain surgery is no small procedure, especially for a teenager. "Once the realization hit I wasn't going to be playing football, I wouldn't be allowed to wrestle, even though I wasn't at risk for having to go through the treatment. It was pretty earth-shattering at that point," he said. Julfs was one of at least 10 people living in rural southeast Iowa, between Wellman and Kelowna, diagnosed with brain tumors in the mid-1990s. The list also included a 16-year-old boy, a 28-year-old farmer, a 50-year-old prison worker, and a 66-year-old farm wife, according to a 1998 Gazette story. This grouping of similar cases in a small geographic area is Iowa's only confirmed cancer cluster in 30 years of investigation. Lynch and former state epidemiologist Patricia Quinslisk called in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to help survey the people near Wellman who had cancer. They also recruited dozens of others in the community to complete surveys as a control group. The goal was to figure out if there was common exposures or other environmental risks nearby. "We looked at pretty much everything that was suspected at that time concerning causation of brain cancer," Lynch said, "including radiation exposure and chemicals in drinking water. They never identified a cause of the tumors." The lack of answers in the Wellman probe mirror national findings about traditional cancer cluster investigations. In a 2012 study, researchers reviewed 428 investigations of 567 cancers of concern and found only 72, or 13%, showed an increased incidence of cancer over control groups. Three cluster investigations were linked to exposures, and only one revealed a clear cause. It is fair to state that extensive efforts to find causes of community cancer clusters have not been successful, the study authors noted. There are fundamental shortcomings to our current methods of investigating community cancer clusters. Cancer researchers are looking for new ways to study environmental risks in Iowa, which has the nation's fastest-growing cancer rate. Comanche, a city of about 4,500 in Clinton County, last year switched to a backup well after learning the well where they had been drawing drinking water was contaminated with per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. These chemicals linked to thyroid cancer were manufactured for years at the 3M plant in Cordova, Illinois, just upstream of Comanche. The Cancer Registry is working with the UI Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination to develop a list of places that should be studied for greater incidence of cancer nearby. The best thing we can do is set up a monitoring system to start watching for signals in places like Comanche to see if they have to start, if they start to have higher rates or distributions of certain types of cancers, Charlton said. An early test of this new approach happened at the site of the former Chamberlain Manufacturing Plant, a Waterloo factory where workers made ammunition in previous decades. Government tests showed heavy metals and other contaminants in the soil. Because cancer is a reportable disease, registry officials were able to look at the cancer rates in the geographic area around the Chamberlain site. They found an excess of prostate cancer in men in the target area, but determined it was not a cluster linked to the former industrial site. Sometimes cancer doesn't show up years or even decades after the exposure. The CDC put out new guidelines in 2022 for cancer cluster investigations. Now the agency recommends epidemiologists look for people with related cancers, not necessarily the exact same kind. The CDC also recommends routine monitoring of past clusters to see if new related cancers develop. The registry now puts some cluster sites on a schedule to look at newly reported cancers in the future. Also from the front page, here's how Iowans are battling the state's dire cancer rates by Brittany Miller of the Gazette. Gary Strike grew up on a farm between towns in northwest Iowa in the 1960s, surrounded by farmland awash with chemicals. His mom smoked like a chimney. His uncle had cancer and traveled at least 5 hours to Iowa City for treatment. Yet cancer was rarely part of any discussion, said Strike, now a lawyer in Cedar Rapids. By chance, he started volunteering with the American Cancer Society in 1977. His advocacy became more personal when his sister was diagnosed with breast cancer, his nephew with testicular cancer, and his wife with thyroid cancer, all in the 2000s. Blood tests and a biopsy in 2016 revealed Strite himself had prostate cancer. Within months, he had surgery to remove his prostate. Now every year, he participates in the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life to fundraise for fighting cancer. Last year, he walked 30 miles to raise more than $100,000. It's been very intentional. If I know somebody else is going through this, I talk them through it, said Strite, who was most recently chair of the Society's Iowa Leadership Board. One of my friends said to me, I just can't believe how open you are about this, he continued. If I broke my arm, I'd tell people about it. People need to get past the stigma, have to get past the fear. Most recently, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin apologized for not making his prostate cancer diagnosis and following hospitalization public. It's now nearly impossible to overlook cancer as Iowa's incidence rates soar to second highest in the country, the Gazette has reported in its Cancer in Iowa series. Members of the Iowa Cancer Consortium are battling the rising rates and advocating for change through the Iowa Cancer Plan. The earlier that cancer is detected, the earlier treatment can begin. Even more importantly, the earlier cancer is discovered, the easier it may be to treat. That's why regular cancer screening, tests that can pinpoint early stages before symptoms arise, is so important. Each exam looks for different signs of cancer. Mammograms, for example, use x-rays to detect tumors in breast tissue before they can be felt. During colonoscopies, doctors look inside the rectum and colon to look for and remove polyps or abnormal tissue growths that could grow into cancer. But some residents face barriers to receiving recommended screenings. Rural patients may be far from their closest provider. Some may not have transportation to get there or the means or insurance coverage to pay for screenings. Others may not even be aware of screening options or their risk levels for certain cancers. Only 10% of Iowans at high risk for lung cancer get screened for the disease, according to the Iowa Cancer Plan. Two-thirds of adults between 45 and 75 years old, the recommended age group, received colorectal cancer screening that met the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force guidelines. Three-fourths of women between 21 and 65 years old were screened for cervical cancer, and about 81% of women between 50 and 74 years old received a mammogram within the past 2 years at the time of the Iowa Cancer Plan's publication. A lot of things in the cancer world are just so unsure, so they're afraid, Strite said. They don't do their colonoscopies. They don't do their mammograms. There are much more effective lung screening methods out there today that people either don't want to go to or they're barriers to going. The Iowa Cancer Plan advocates for efforts that raise public awareness about cancer screening, especially for the communities most in need. The plan also calls for community-based strategies that strengthen trust in such services and the healthcare system. It says cancer disparities data can help accomplish these goals by identifying gaps in access, cost, and care quality. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends screening tests for breast, cervical, and colorectal cancers. It also advocates for lung cancer screening for high-risk people. It says that screening for ovarian, pancreatic, prostate, testicular, and thyroid cancers has not been shown to reduce deaths from those cancers. Also from the front page, Iowa will no longer have state park rangers under plan. Rangers will be replaced with regional conservation officers, by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Iowa state parks will no longer have park rangers under a new alignment plan being executed by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Rangers at Iowa's 69 state parks all will gradually be reclassified as conservation officers assigned to one or more counties rather than assigned to a specific state park or parks, the department confirmed. Under alignment, state park managers and natural resources technicians will exclusively handle state park operations, allowing DNR's sworn peace officers to solely focus on law enforcement tasks, Iowa DNR spokeswoman Tammy Crossman said in an email. But park advocates say the change will mean reduced law enforcement presence at state park, which in the summer become hubs of activity that can involve overconsumption of alcohol, unsafe boating, and criminal activity. Anywhere there is alcohol, law enforcement presence needs to be known, especially when you're out in the middle of nowhere, said Dawn Bill, president of Friends of Pilot Knob, a group that supports Pilot Knob State Park in north central Iowa. Even though the Iowa DNR is making changes according to an alignment plan, when the Gazette asked for a copy, Crossman said the plan was still a draft, which makes it not subject to public disclosure under Iowa's open records law. As sworn law enforcement officers, park rangers for decades also have been jacks of all trades who do everything from repairing buildings and overseeing mowing to educating the public about invasive species and cracking down on out-of-control parties at campgrounds. The Iowa DNR told rangers in 2022 they had to move out of the 26 state-owned houses in state parks, saying the upkeep was too costly. That meant instead of being on site for busy weekends, rangers could live as far as 20 miles away. But rangers have continued to have responsibility to specific parks, where they spend most of their days. It's because of Pilot Knob Ranger Michael Strausser that his state park has a friends group, which helps with programming and raising money for the park that celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. "I've been camping out at Pilot Knob forever," said Bill, who lives in Clear Lake. "We started in a tent, we went to a pop-up trailer, and now we have a big 36-footer. In the summer of 2018, she was talking with Strausser, who regularly walks around the 60-spot campground on weekends to talk with campers. He said he had park improvement plans, but didn't know if he had enough money in the budget. I'm like, "Well, don't you have a friends group?" He said, "No." I said, "Maybe we should start one." Bill said, "The group's first event in fall 2018 drew about 150 people for winter prep, including staining and painting park buildings. Iowa State Parks, visited by up to 16 million people a year, need more than $100 million in repairs for fixing leaking roofs and rotting shelters and updating sewage lagoons. The Gazette reported this month, Iowa DNR Director Kayla Lyon has not asked the Iowa legislature for additional funding in recent years. The Iowa DNR plans to start the alignment process by moving Strausser and Katie Hoppner, the ranger at Lewis and Clark State Park near Onawa, to a hybrid status where they will be responsible for two counties each. Pete Hildreth, the agency's Conservation and Recreation Division Administrator, said in a March 22nd email to Parks employees. "The plan is not designed to save money. The changes are not expected to affect safety in the parks. It will be exactly as it is now," Krausman said. "Anyone experiencing an emergency in a state park or any other public area should call 911. The dispatcher will direct the closest law enforcement to respond. This is not a change from the current protocol. The Iowa DNR will rely on seasonal officers to enforce rules and laws during exceptionally busy times of the year. These are park rangers, park technicians, and night security officers sworn in as temporary officers from April 15th to October 15th. These officers receive at least 24 hours of training, which includes 8 hours riding with full-time sworn police officer." Bill says seasonal officers are not enough, and sheriff's deputies and Iowa State troopers don't have the time to be a regular presence in the state park. "That's going to be the biggest problem with this merger," she said. "I don't care what they want to call Michael. If you want to call him a conservation officer or a park ranger, or I don't know, Santa Claus, I don't care. He needs to be a law enforcement officer in the park." Turning to the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, Reynolds signs AEA bill. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law a bill overhauling the funding and operation of Iowa's area education agencies, notching a win on her top policy priority after 11 weeks of negotiation between House and Senate Republicans. Flanked by lawmakers and state education officials, Reynolds said the law would bring meaningful and necessary reform to the system. In addition to AEA changes, the law will increase state aid to K-12 schools by 2.5% and raise the minimum teacher salary to $50,000 over 2 years. The special education funding that now goes to the AEAs will go to the school districts, who will need to continue using the AEAs for 90% of that money or send it into the school's general fund. It also gives schools control over their media and other education services that now fund the AEAs. Eminent domain review passed. The Iowa House passed a bill last week that will allow landowners to ask a court to review eminent domain authority of proposed pipeline projects before the project receives approval from the Iowa Utilities Board. It is unclear if the Senate will consider the bill. The measure comes out of opposition to the construction of carbon pipelines proposed in the state. Reynolds deploying troops. Governor Kim Reynolds is sending another round of National Guard troops and state police to the U.S.-Mexico border to aid Texas border enforcement efforts. 10 Iowa Department of Public Safety officers and troopers were set to deploy Sunday for 28 days. Also, 110 Guard members will deploy between April 1st and May 3rd, while another 5 will deploy for vehicle maintenance and public affairs support from April 1st to September 30th. Lawmakers criticize Davenport transparency. A House committee heard from witnesses about the lack of transparency from Davenport over settlement agreements signed in secret and approved without a public vote. Lawmakers called the city's handling of public records disgraceful and said they would like more information about how the city handled its $1.6 million separation with its former administrator and respond to public records requests. Fertilizer spill causes large fish kill. More than 750,000 fish in a 60-mile stretch along a western Iowa river were killed after a spill that dumped more than 250,000 gallons of liquid nitrogen fertilizer into the East Nishnabotna River earlier this month, according to the Iowa Capital Dispatch. It was one of the largest fish kills on record, stretching from Red Oak into Missouri. Under the heading, They Said, some schools haven't used some of the AEA services despite being forced to pay for them. Others have felt that they didn't receive the quality that they expect, and many schools, urban and rural, large and small, have raised concerns about a lack of transparency regarding the cost of AEA services. Governor Kim Reynolds, after signing AEA changes into law. And parents, educators, students, and community leaders changed the course of this legislation. They prevented Republican politicians from fast-tracking this bill and exposed Governor Reynolds' misplaced priorities. Senator Pam Yoakum, Democrat Dubuque, on the new AEA law. Under the heading Odds and Ends, budget targets. Iowa House and Senate Republicans released their targets for state spending last week, looking to spend close to $9 billion on state operations and services. House Republicans set their budget target at $8.95 billion, while Senate Republicans set an $8.87 billion target. The number is well below expected revenue, which GOP leaders say is a sign further tax cuts are needed. Pipe tax passes. A higher excise tax on glass and metal pipes, which are sold as tobacco products but often used to smoke marijuana, is headed to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for a signature. The bill would tax the products 40% and use the revenue to create specialty courts to address substance abuse and mental health issues. Under the heading Water Cooler, Iowa Gymnastics, University of Iowa Athletics is conducting a review of gymnastics head coach Larissa Libby amid concerns about the culture and environment of the program, the university said Thursday. Libby was placed on administrative leave while the review takes place. And tax amendments proposed. Iowa Republican lawmakers are looking to enshrine their tax-cutting agenda into the Iowa Constitution. They are proposing a pair of constitutional amendments that would require a two-thirds majority vote of the legislature to raise income taxes and require the state to have a flat tax. The proposals would need to be passed by two separate general assemblies and then approved by a majority of Iowa voters in a ballot measure. Todd Dorman writes in his 24-hour Dorman column, Iowa GOP wants to control future. Surely, there will be no end to Iowa Republicans' invincible statehouse majority. Their electoral dominance is clear, their agenda will make Iowa a low-tax economic mecca, and Iowa Democrats are in disarray with seemingly few prospects for a comeback. But maybe future Iowans won't appreciate 2024 GOP wisdom. Unthinkable, but possible. Just in case the Red Dynasty is ever forced to abdicate the throne, its grand edifices must be protected. So Republicans are pushing for a constitutional amendment requiring future legislators to muster a two-thirds vote in each chamber to raise the personal or corporate income tax. House Joint Resolution 2006, which includes the amendment, was approved by the Iowa House 61-35. You'll note yes votes did not add up to a two-thirds majority. To be clear, the amendment must pass the Senate this year and both the House and Senate during the next two-year General Assembly. Then it's subject to a statewide vote. Not exactly a slam dunk. But if the amendment is added to the Constitution, it will lock in tomorrow whatever income tax changes majority Republicans and Governor Kim Reynolds make today. When they're through flattening income tax rates or eliminating the income tax completely, future Iowans and their elected representatives will play hell trying to undo 2024's tax decisions, even if there's a darn good reason. Never mind that I can't recall a legislative vote in my years of covering and watching the legislature that raised the income tax. It's hard enough without junking up the Constitution. A second constitutional amendment under consideration would bar the legislature from enacting any income tax rates that are not flat. So it basically outlaws the progressive income tax, where wealthier earners pay a higher percentage of their income than low and middle income Iowans. It's a system that is so unfair to big Republican donors. We must help them. Lawmakers would be free to raise the sales tax, which, as a percentage of income, hits low and middle income Iowans hardest. The ability of Republican tax cutters to travel into the future and tie the hands of lawmakers who may be governing in an entirely different state is just one fun feature. Consider the fact that, no matter the situation, it will take just 34 House members and 17 senators to block legislation undoing any income tax damage done by the current majority. So in a General Assembly with 150 lawmakers total, 51 members will rule on income tax policy. A minority becomes a majority when it comes to taxes. In our constitutional republic, run by democratically elected representatives, giving a minority that much power seems like a bad idea. Basically, no votes have more clout than yes votes. But Republicans would like to lock in their agenda so future libs can cry more, I guess. In 2022, Iowa voters overwhelmingly approved an amendment saying the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The sovereign state of Iowa affirms and recognizes this right to be a fundamental individual right. Any and all restrictions of this right shall be subject to strict scrutiny. The amendment delivers orders to future Iowa courts to subject any gun regulation to the highest level of judicial review. If someday the state bans vaporizing laser guns, it's going to need a compelling reason for doing so. Lawmakers also pursued a constitutional amendment declaring the state constitution does not secure a right to abortion. Then the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe, and the last things Republicans wanted was an up or down vote on abortion, so they scrapped the amendment. This tax limit isn't even a new idea. In 1999, voters rejected an amendment requiring a 60% supermajority to raise taxes and a second limiting spending. Now the supermajority is back. Tell you what, I won't get worked up about these constitution changes if Republicans also consider an amendment giving Iowans the power of petition and referendum. Let's allow Iowans to put measures on the ballot. Want legal abortion protected? Let's vote on it. Want legalized recreational marijuana but can't get it through our reefer madness legislature? Let's vote on it. A higher minimum wage? Clean up our waters? Address mental health system failures? Let's put all of it on the ballot. Add this to your amendment, Republicans, and you can prove you're not authoritarians who can't stand the thought Iowa's political winds might shift. Bristle at the left calling you enemies of democracy? Giving Iowans a powerful voice at the ballot would prove them wrong. Do something right before your invincibility runs out of juice. And a guest column from David V. Wendell. David V. Wendell is a Marian historian, author, and special events coordinator specializing in American history. He writes, if you enjoy Girl Scout cookies, thank Iowa's Lou Henry Hoover. This month marks the 150th birthday of Lou Henry Hoover, daughter of Iowa, respected scientist, First Lady of the United States, and co-founder of the Girl Scout cookie program. Lou was born March 29, 1874 in Waterloo. Her father, Charles Henry, was a prominent local banker. When Lou was 11, the family moved to Whittier, California. Lou developed a deep appreciation for nature during her childhood on the prairies of Iowa and was fascinated by geology. In 1894, she enrolled in the education department at Stanford University, but changed her major to geological sciences, where she was the only woman in her class. While there, she met a young metallurgy student, also from Iowa, named Herbert Hoover. He graduated in 1895, and she received her degree in 1898. A year later, they were married at her parents' house in nearby Monterey. Her husband immediately found employment with a mining company in China, and the newlywed couple settled at Tientsin along the Yellow Sea east of Beijing. While there, they were trapped by the Boxer Rebellion. After the uprising, both became known for their knowledge of minerals and organizational skills. The Hoovers returned to the United States ahead of World War I. Herbert was put in charge of the Washington, D.C. Commission for Relief in Belgium, which was experiencing a devastating famine. In 3 years, 2.5 million tons of food nourished more than 9 million people. At the same time, Juliet Lowe, the founder of Girl Scouts of America, opened an office in the nation's capital. Lou joined the board of directors, then was appointed vice president in 1917. After World War I, Herbert Hoover was again tapped to bring nutrition to Europe and Asia when Russia could not produce enough food for its citizens. He was named director of the American Relief Administration and built and supplied 19,000 community kitchens that provided meals to more than 12 million people. Lou helped raise money for the organization and simultaneously was named editor of the American Girl magazine, a publication sponsored by the Girl Scouts. In 1922, Lou was credited with helping start what would become one of the largest annual charitable fundraising efforts in history. It was with her as editor that the magazine published, for the first time, a recipe for a basic sugar cookie that could be sold to raise money for local Girl Scout troops. It laid out the recipe and went on to show that for 26 cents, ingredients could be purchased to bake 6 dozen cookies that could be sold for 25 cents a dozen. In so doing, the magazine and its editor had printed the ingredients for what would become a cherished annual American tradition. Lou was named president of the organization in 1922 and wasted no time in starting other traditions that expanded the appeal of Girl Scouts nationwide. In 1923, the National Better Homes Convention was held in Washington, D.C., and a wooden house was erected just outside the White House grounds where classes were taught on homemaking and women's issues of the day. Seeing the interest that had piqued in the minds of children who visited, Lou provided a check for $12,000 to have the house moved to a permanent location in D.C. It was so successful that similar little houses were erected for Girl Scouts in cities across the country. After her husband was named Secretary of Commerce, she left her Girl Scouts position in 1925, but remained active with the organization. In 1928, as her husband ran for president, the couple visited Cedar Rapids. Lou remembered fondly her time in Waterloo, where she learned many of the principles she would espouse as leader of her Girl Scout troop. Herbert won the election in a landslide, defeating New York Governor Alfred E. Smith with 357 electoral votes to Smith's 88. After moving into the White House, the new First Lady brought the Girl Scouts with her as she presided over the meetings of Troop No. 8 in the Executive Mansion. She also invited and hosted Jessie DePriest, the wife of Oscar DePriest, the first black congressman from a northern state, at a tea party at the White House. On October 29, 1929, the stock market crashed and precipitated what would become the worst economic depression in history. Even though it began less than 6 months into his presidency, Hoover received the blame. In 1932, he lost the election to Franklin D. Roosevelt. Hoover continued to work in food relief for the country along with the former First Lady, and they split their time between California and New York. Girl Scouts of America had since moved into a headquarters in New York, and Lou again became president in 1935. She advocated that, in response to the Great Depression, the organization should teach economics as well as homemaking skills. That year, the first commercially produced cookies were introduced with a Girl Scout label. The cookies allowed the Girl Scouts to learn marketing and salesmanship on a far larger scale. Lou resigned the presidency in 1937, but just as with the Little Houses in the 1922 magazine article, she had provided the proverbial recipe that saw the Girl Scouts expand to more than 1.5 million members, selling in excess of 200 million boxes of cookies every year. Lou Henry Hoover died in 1944 and was buried in Palo Alto, California. Her husband survived her for 20 years before dying in 1964. The former president of the United States and humanitarian was laid to rest on a hilltop overlooking his childhood home in West Branch. Lou's body was moved from California, and the couple now rest side by side in plots marked with modest white stones that can be seen from his family's cottage. Thousands of Girl Scouts have paid their respects at the graveside ever since. Turning to the Insight page, the community letters, and the editorial cartoon from cartoonist Joe Heller, based in Green Bay. It says, Happy Easter, and it is a drawing of a cave with the rock rolled away that says Matthew 28:6. The first letter today is from Gary Warner of Cedar Rapids. AEA system isn't equal, it's equitable. In Althea Cole's March 17th column, it was pointed out that several superintendents across the state openly called for reform of the state's AEA system. What she failed to mention is that as the governor was drawing up her plan to eviscerate the AEAs, she did not consult with educators in the state. The input for her decisions came from an out-of-state entity. Educators are not afraid of change, but they would like to be involved in the decisions being made about what the changes might be. AEAs work with educators and families in those communities to make sure the students are getting the best education possible. The amount of services an individual district may need in a given year will vary over time. This is not an equal system, but it is certainly equitable. The state's AEAs are like firefighters and EMTs. A community doesn't need them every day, but when a house starts burning or when someone has a heart attack, they are needed right away, and they are available. When a district suddenly needs a certain service from the AEA and there is no one there to respond in a timely and appropriate manner, the end result will be less support for our state students. I think it can be agreed no one wants that. Gary Warner of Cedar Rapids. Next, Linda Kincaid of Iowa City writes, State funds to DNR for raccoon bounties? I am writing to express my strong opposition to Iowa House File 2665, renumbered from HF 2481, which proposes to create a state-funded raccoon bounty program. While I understand the concerns regarding raccoon populations and their impact on certain areas, implementing a bounty program is not the solution we need. First and foremost, the estimated cost of $860,000 annually is an astronomical figure, especially considering the current economic challenges facing our state and our people. Instead of allocating resources to a bounty program, these funds could be used for initiatives such as conservation efforts, education on coexisting with wildlife, or addressing more pressing issues within our community. Instead of resorting to a bounty system, we should focus on implementing humane and effective methods for managing raccoon populations while respecting the ecological balance. This may include non-lethal deterrence, habitat modification, and community education. The DNR already has a program to help landowners address problems with wildlife. Why isn't there a bill to fund that instead? And where is the DNR in all of this exactly? Last week I read headlines saying the DNR needs $100 million for repairs to our state parks. I say this $860,000 is a good place to start. In conclusion, I urge lawmakers to reconsider HF 2665 and explore alternative approaches that prioritize both fiscal responsibility and ethical wildlife management. Linda Kincaid of Iowa City. Next, Lynn Gallagher of Solon writes, Raccoon Bounty Bill is taxpayer-funded cruelty. This year's Raccoon Bounty Bill, HF 2665, is a state-sanctioned and taxpayer-subsidized animal cruelty. The legislation's goal is to incentivize the trapping, clubbing, and skinning of raccoons. Lawmakers and committees on the bill have said the fur trapping industry is hurting because of low sales. They also say that raccoons are eating too much corn. The estimated cost of this farce is $860,000 a year. If someone wants fewer raccoons on his farm, he already has the legal ability to do what he wants. He can already hire a trapper. I shouldn't have to pay for it. The legislature has an opportunity to say no to nonsense like this. The bill should be tabled and shouldn't even be given a chance for a vote. But when it does inevitably get called to the floor, our state representative should reject it. Please contact your legislators and tell them to vote no. Lynn Gallagher of Solon. Next, Rich Patterson of Cedar Rapids writes, Taxpayers pay to lure companies like Google. As schools lay off custodians and teachers and Iowa state parks fall apart, we're about to grant Google, one of the world's richest companies, a $56 million tax break to come here. These come from different tax pots, but it's still public money. Big companies are adept at playing one community against others to see who will give them the best deal. It sounds great, but frequently the new company demands expensive, expanded services including roads, sewers, clean water, and energy. Some people and companies stand to reap profits if Google comes here, but more residents will eventually be left holding the bag. Wealthy tech companies have so driven up the cost of living in Seattle, Silicon Valley, and suburban New Jersey that teachers, first responders, and nurses can no longer afford to live there and must commute great distances. Do we really want to duplicate these problems here? I ask government and business interests to think long and hard before granting freebies to Google. The best course may be to encourage them to go elsewhere. Rich Patterson of Cedar Rapids. And Patrick Nolte of Ely writes, Corn is growing, but Iowa towns are not. As a 70-year-old fifth-generation Iowan, I couldn't be more disillusioned with the current totalitarian Republican Party. I know that poor management and greed over need has shrunk the western Ogallala Aquifer to near extinction, and the corporate Republican-leaning farm industry here in Iowa is trying to do the same for us. They aren't satisfied with polluting our streams, rivers, and wells with excess fertilizers to grow 50% more corn than is needed for food. Now they, Terry Branstad and Bruce Rastetter, want to pump billions of gallons of aquifer water from reserves that took eons of time to fill so they can pump ethanol waste CO2 to North Dakota. Has the current industrial farming model repopulated your small towns? It hasn't done so for the small town I grew up in. The next time you hear that corporate commercial Iowa doesn't grow corn, corn grows Iowa, do yourself a favor and look around your small town. Patrick Nolte of Ely. And quotes of the week, Governor Kim Reynolds signing a bill altering the structure of AEA agencies and raising teacher pay, Reynolds says, While this bill has been the focus of much discussion and debate, it has also presented opportunities for insightful conversations and meaningful compromise. Next, House Democratic leader Jennifer Confirst criticizing the Republicans' AEA bill. When you look at the celebration Reynolds is having, I want you to think about the families who have so much uncertainty now as they're wondering what will happen to the AEA services in their communities, what will happen to their kids who are getting AEA services. Next, Alyssa Brule, communications director for Iowa Attorney General Brennan Byrd, explaining why Byrd continues to cut off state reimbursements to sexual assault victims for emergency contraception and, in rare cases, abortion. She says that audit is ongoing. Next, State Auditor Rob Sand explaining his opposition to Byrd's policy of withholding reimbursements for sexual assault victims. Sand says, And the trauma and the pain that the Attorney General's decision is putting victims through, in this case, literally makes my skin crawl. And finally, Lise Williams, Iowa City School Board member, explaining the board's decision to close Hills Elementary, says, "I understand this is a significant decision with serious ramifications for the Hills community. I do not believe the closure of Hills will have an adverse impact on students." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 31st, 2024. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. And we turn to today's obituaries. One other notice, Deborah Williams Chambers, age 58, died March 21st. Services pending with Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. William Joseph Leonard, known as BJ of Solon, left this life and joined our Heavenly Father and his family on March 28th after a long health battle. Visitation will be held Wednesday, April 3rd from 9:30 to 10:30 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 Wednesday, April 3rd at St. Mary's. Burial will be at St. Bridget's Cemetery, Nolan Settlement. After the services, a luncheon to follow at the Solon American Legion. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon are overseeing arrangements. He was in the Army Reserve after high school and then farmed with his dad, brother-in-law, and nephew. BJ enjoyed his time with friends and family. He will be remembered for his sense of humor in hosting some of the most memorable 4th of July fish fries and card parties at his cabin on the Cedar River. When he wasn't at home, you could be sure to find him at Sutliff playing cards with his buddies. He truly loved living on the Cedar River and enjoyed fishing, hunting, and viewing all the wildlife. BJ was a proud member of the Solon American Legion for over 50 years. He was also involved in the early years of Solon Beef Days. David Ludvicek, 63, of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 27th in his home. Graveside services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th, at Castex Cemetery near Swisher. Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center is in charge of arrangements. Beverly A. Sweet, known as Bev, age 74, of Solon, passed away March 25th at the Solon Nursing Care Center. Graveside services will be held 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd, at Oakland Cemetery in Solon. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon are in charge of arrangements. Sweet was who she was, always smiling, always willing to help, always caring for someone else. She was very passionate about many things, people, flowers, and animals being her favorites. Bev began her career in 1968 at the University of Iowa School of Social Work. She earned her BA in English from Iowa in 1998 while working full-time. During her career of 47 years, she had a big hand in admissions of student relations, shepherding 6,228 graduates through the School of Social Work. Bev retired in 2015 and spent her retirement gardening in her yard in her hometown of Solon. Sandra Kathleen Shea Maresch of Loveland, Colorado, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died on March 21st. Sandra spent the bulk of her career working in the emergency room of Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids and at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinic's DeGowan Blood Donor Center. Sandra enjoyed working with fabric and crocheting. While not athletic, she loved the challenge and competition she experienced while geocaching. While she hated cooking for one, she loved cooking for others and enjoyed cooking with her daughter. Her cats were her companion and very much a part of her life. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is overseeing local arrangements. Mary Ann Root, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, died February 24th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha from complications from a longtime battle with cancer. Services 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13th at Tien Funeral Home, burial Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Mary Ann worked for the Sisters of Mercy as an accountant for 10 years and at the Black & Decker Company in Baltimore, Maryland. She was a member of Lovely Lane Methodist Church and was a volunteer at Hospice and Stevens Ministry. Mary Ann was a quiet, gentle woman with a smile everyone loved to see. She always went out of her way to be a great friend. Mary Ann liked researching the genealogy of families and enjoyed wintering in Green Valley, Arizona. Rosemary Frost, age 87, of Hiawatha, died March 20th at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha after a courageous battle with cancer. Funeral Mass, 11 a.m., Friday, April 12th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Friends may visit with the family beginning at 10 a.m. at the church. Burial to follow at 2 p.m., Santa Maria Cemetery in Gilbertville. Tien Funeral Home is caring for Rosemary and her family. Jack L. Zuber, age 87, of Bakersfield, California, died March 21st. A memorial service is planned for a later date. He was a veteran who served 7 years in the Army Reserve and 30 years in the Air Force Reserve. He had 30 years in the Iowa Wing of the Civil Air Patrol. Jack was employed at Rockwell Collins for 32 years as an engineering lab tech. Sylvia Keel, born Sylvia Peterson of Hiawatha, passed away peacefully on March 23rd in her sleep following a long illness related to a broken heart. No services are planned. She will be cremated and placed with her loving husband in an urn forever. Sylvia and Tom love to cruise and have traveled the world in doing so. She was loud and boisterous to all. Everyone who knew her enjoyed her fun and engaging personality. Darla June Clark, age 87, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away on February 24th in Lakewood, Colorado. While attending Iowa, Darla was a drummer with the Scottish Highlanders Bagpipe and Drum Band. Besides halftime game performances at Iowa, the Highlanders performed at the White House during the Eisenhower administration and appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in New York prior to departing aboard the Queen Mary for a three-month tour in Europe. Darla and Jack spent their winter vacation skiing resorts, mostly in Colorado. They enjoyed many memorable trips to the Caribbean, snorkeling, sailing, and generally carousing. Darla was interred at Cedar Memorial Park on March 19th. Nancy Ann Hauksey of Caledonia, Minnesota, passed away peacefully at Clada Senior Living in Minnesota on November 13, 2023. Nancy worked at Coe College and then Kirkwood Community College. She also worked part-time at Kay's Merchandise, Yonkers, and Von Maur. In her free time, Nancy liked to be creative and do crafts. She enjoyed music, traveling, and spending time with family. A graveside service will be held in the spring at 11 a.m. on April 6th at Oakland Cemetery in Waukon. Agnes Hammond, age 82, of Atkins, formerly of Cedar Rapids, became a Silent Key KBO EHC on March 23rd. She loved the outdoors. Anyone who met Agnes would say she is the nicest person they had ever met. Per her wishes, there will be no visitation or services. The Reverend Charles Osler Wilming passed away peacefully on March 1st in Salem, Oregon. He followed his father's path into the ministry and served several churches in Missouri. And he also was ordained a minister in the Presbyterian Church. Chuck then became a chaplain in the U.S. Air Force, first at Lackland, San Antonio, then assignments at Barksdale, Louisiana, about a year on Iwo Jima, and finally Gardner Field in Spokane. Chuck's civilian callings began in 1959 when he became associate pastor at Millwood PC, WA, and then at First PC in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Chuck and his growing family returned to the Pacific Northwest in 1962, where he became the pastor of Gateway PC in Dallas, Oregon. Celebration of Life gatherings will be held following Sunday service at John Knox PC in Kaiser on April 14th and Westminster PC in Eugene, Oregon on May 5th. A graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids on Saturday, April 27th at 11 a.m. Russell Lyman Hendricks, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 14th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha with his wife by his side. A private celebration of Russell's life is planned for family and friends. Russell joined the United States Air Force in 1967. He served 4 years with a deployment in Germany before being medically discharged with the rank of Staff Sergeant. Russell worked as a lab technician at Cargill for 45 years before retiring. He was proud to be the only lab technician without a college degree. Russell was soft-spoken but loved striking up a conversation or sharing stories with friends, families, co-workers, and even strangers. Russell loved classic cars and, as a former airman, retained an interest in airplanes. He was also an amateur bird watcher and bird photographer. He had a large collection of LPs and was an avid NPR listener and nonfiction reader, and was particularly curious about keeping up with science news. Joyce K. Barrington, age 84, of Marion, passed away on March 26th at Summit Point Memory Care Unit. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 4th, at Hope United Church of Christ, located at 150 9th Avenue in Hiawatha, where the family will greet friends from 9 a.m. until the service time. A private interment will take place at a later date at Greenlawn Cemetery in Redfield, South Dakota. Joyce was employed with Rockwell Collins as an office manager in acquisitions for several years until her retirement in 2002. Joyce was a member of the Hope United Church of Christ, where she was very influential and involved in many aspects of church life, including directing and singing in the choir, playing piano and organ, and teaching Sunday school. She was also very active at First Christian Church in McAllen, Texas during her retirement years, being a church elder and deacon. Joyce also took great pride in being a chaplain at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids for people in need for many years. She also participated and sang in the choir at Rockwell Collins. Joyce was a member of the Red Hat Society. She loved to play bridge and a mean game of cribbage, along with the love of the outdoors and a fierce competitor in golf. Verla Jean Amott Keeling, age 91, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, March 23rd at Creekside Living in Grundy Center. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 5th at Trinity Lutheran Church, 213 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, April 4th at Major Erickson Funeral Home, 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue, Mason City. Interment will be held in Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. James Michael Ellis, known as Mick, age 65, of Cedar Rapids, passed away unexpectedly on March 25th. A memorial service with military honors will be held 11 a.m. Saturday, April 13th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. The family will greet friends 1 hour prior to the service, beginning at 10 a.m. at the chapel. A gathering will be held following the memorial service at the Cedar Memorial Family Center. Jeffrey Wayne Fensel, age 56, of Solon, passed away on March 21st at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha following a battle with cancer. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, April 6th, from 1 to 4 at the Saints Peter and Paul Historical Chapel, located 1165 Taft Avenue Northeast in Solon. Casual dress, please. Jeff enjoyed buying and selling at flea markets, auctions, and garage sales. And Richard L. Bednar, age 83, of Vinton, died on March 28th at Virginia Gay Nursing and Rehab in Vinton. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 3rd, at the Garrison Cemetery with Reverend Stephen Prius officiating. Richard worked in building maintenance at Rockwell Collins for 33 years. He was an excellent athlete and loved sports of all kinds. He especially enjoyed watching his kids and grandkids in their athletic endeavors. He was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church, the Vinton County Country Club, and the IBEW. Turning to the sports page, Mike Kloss writes, Clark and a happy Iowa team had a blast blasting Colorado in Albany, New York. The scripting was exactly what was desired by Hawkeye fan, ESPN, and especially Planet Caitlin Clark, with its ports continuing to multiply. The story 99.4% of those who care wanted when the NCAA women's tournament's pairings were released 2 weeks ago has come to fruition. Reigning national champion LSU and the 2023 runner-up in a regional final, Clark and Angel Reese, again. Iowa did what a number one seed is supposed to do Saturday and disposed of 5-seed Colorado in the NCAA Women's Tournament Sweet 16 at MVP Arena, 89-68. The Hawkeyes play LSU here Monday night because the Tigers dropped UCLA earlier Saturday, 78-69. Whether Monday's result differs from the one in Dallas last April remains to be seen, but Iowa gave itself the chance to make it so, and did with authority, shaking off its un-Hawkeyes form in its 65-54 win over West Virginia on Monday to get back to crisp, authoritative offense. Maybe it was freeing to be on the road again instead of worrying about possibly disappointing 14,000-some devoted followers in Carver Hawkeye Arena. Maybe Colorado's defense bore little resemblance to West Virginia's. And maybe Lisa Bluter is a really good coach. Bluter did what flies in the face of most college coaches do, women and men, and it paid off. Clark committed her second foul with 6-7 left in the second quarter. Most of her peers, women and men, get a player out of the game with 2 first-half fouls to avoid being saddled with a third before halftime. When you have a rare bird that is too good and too savvy to pick up a third personal before the break, though, you let that birdie fly. I thought the 2 fouls she got were kind of touch fouls, Bluter said. They were just kind of like, eh, that could have been called, maybe not called. To me, she's so smart. I just talked to her a little bit, just said, hey, be careful, you've got 2. But she is one smart basketball player, and I really trust her. Clark was out for 131 of that 607, but didn't come out until over 3 minutes after that second foul. Between foul number 2 and halftime, she scored 3 baskets and had a sensational long pass to Sydney Afolter for an assist. Iowa's lead was 32-21 when Clark got her second personal. She and her teammates weren't a bit tentative in those last 6 minutes of the half and went to the break with a 48-35 lead. 6 minutes without Clark, who wound up with 29 points and 15 assists, is what would have been the real risky business. Honestly, Clark said, I think when I step on the court, like a calming sense come over me. This is where I'm supposed to be. I have 13 amazing teammates that have my back. I guess it's just kind of like, let your work shine, go have fun, go have a blast, and win or lose, there's a lot to hold your head high about. I thought that's exactly what we did. Everybody kind of played with a smile on their face and had a lot of fun. It was true. Forward Sydney Afolter drove hard for a basket and was fouled midway through the first quarter. She was sprawled on the floor with a wry smile. She hit the deck at least another 2 times on drives that punished the Buffaloes and seemed to enjoy each spill. Late in the game, Clark got trapped by 2 Colorado players before getting the ball to a fellow Hawkeye and grinned at one of her rare tiny failures this day. It was a day for smiles, for a game so well played after 2 imperfect NCAA wins at home. Immediately afterward, everyone wanted to ask Iowa's players and head coach about the 3-letter bad word, LSU. I speak for everybody on our team, Clark said. We did not come into this game knowing LSU had won, and we're like, oh, we want to win to play LSU. We focused on this game. It showed, but, ahem, what about the next one? Yeah, I think everybody's pretty excited for it, said Bluter. 12 million people tuned in last year to see this game. Might be the same this time. Who knows? I just know it's going to be highly emotional and highly competitive. The Albany area was first settled in 1614. It has never experienced anything sports-wise like what's coming Monday night. Jessica Klein and Rob Klein write their History Happenings column for the Historical Center. Cedar Rapids Bunnies. Baseball fans raised $7,000 during the Depression to install lights. It is almost time for another baseball season to get underway, and your correspondents fervently believe that is cause for celebration. To gear up for the 2024 season, the elder of these writers has been reading a variety of books about the national pastime. Of most note for this column is The Worldly Game, the story of baseball in the Amana Colonies, written by Monis A. Hagen and published by Iowa City's Penfield Press. Drawing heavily on oral histories, Hagen traces baseball in the Amanas from the period when the elders of the community, rather ineffectually, forbade the playing of the game in the early part of the 20th century, to the eventual demise of organized baseball in the communities a few years before the end of the 20th century. As a general rule, our monthly investigations into area history are bound by the borders of Linn County. The Amana colonies are in Iowa County, so it might seem as if we've given up our usual home field advantage to play an away game. But Hagen's book includes quite a number of interesting facts and anecdotes about baseball in Linn County and its various connections to baseball in the Amana colonies. Among them is the story of a significant innovation that was implemented in Cedar Rapids well before the major leagues caught up. Hagen recounts the difficulties faced by baseball clubs at all levels during the Great Depression. To keep the game vibrant and operating in the black, teams had to find creative and appealing ways to convince people to come out to the ballpark. We'll let him recount what that meant in Linn County. In Cedar Rapids, the owners and community leaders thought that Cedar Rapids could not afford to relinquish its franchise in the Sippy League and installed floodlights for night games to bolster attendance. For Cedar Rapids, with its economy tied to manufacturing and agriculture, night games did not compete with daytime employments. Fans responded enthusiastically, and attendance exceeded expectations. At an August 1932 game against Keokuk, over 3,000 spectators packed Bunny Stadium, leaving standing room only along the third baseline. 4 years ahead of Major League fans, baseball enthusiasts in Cedar Rapids enjoyed night games. The Friday, August 7, 1931 edition of the Cedar Rapids Tribune covered the Bunny's first night game on its front page, taking the apparently numerous doubters to task for their lack of faith in the plan to light up the field. Under the headline, "Popularity of Night Baseball Here Assured," the paper printed, "Doubting Thomases, who did more than their share of crepe hanging last spring when local baseball enthusiasts started out to rejuvenate interest in the game by the installation of lights for night playing, should have been among the more than 3,000 wild-eyed fans at Bunny Park last Monday night." Wild eyes strikes us as an odd way to describe the local baseball fans, but perhaps the lights were truly dazzling. In any case, despite this swipe at the Doubting Thomases, it isn't too hard to understand why some people were unsure about the plan. The same article reported, "This year, the local boosters faced a $4,000 obligation at the outset, and when it was decided to take a whirl at night games, an additional fund of about $7,000 was required. There still remains a deficit of a few hundred dollars before the lighting equipment is paid for, and the solicitation of contributions will be continued until the entire amount is secured." That $7,000 in 1931 was equivalent to more than $133,000 in today's dollars, a hefty and potentially risky outlay of funds during the Depression. But the Tribune, and apparently the local fans, were all in on night baseball. The article concludes with the following pitch. "The enjoyment of night baseball cannot be described, and one does not have to be a devotee of the game to get a kick out of it. Anyone who has not yet watched the Bunnies caper around under the floodlights in the West Side Ball Yard has missed a lot of fun and a good sport. It's cool and comfortable out there. The admission fee is reasonable. The boys are playing great ball. The Rooters have some new gags, and Cedar Rapids is certainly becoming baseball-minded. Join the crowd and exercise your lungs. We'll be in the crowd to see the local team this summer. We hope to see you at the ballpark." And finally today, Kurt Ulrich's guest column, "April Arrives on Wings and in Poetry." Okay, it snowed here again, and like me, it's getting old. By the time you read this missive, the landscape will be changing quickly, from the melt and muck of March to what writer Bray Bradbury called a land as bright, beloved, and blue as any Yeats found to be true. Or as Yeats' contemporary A.E. Housman so beautifully penned in his collection of poems, A Shropshire Lad, "When in spring we turn toward the pastoral, whether it be out a back window or on a trip to a nearby town along a scenic ridgeline," Housman asks, "what are those blue remembered hills? What spires, what farms are those?" And I can answer the question, at least for me, a simple man who loves poetry but was never educated in the intricacies of the stuff. Probably would have ruined it for me had I been. The blue remembered hills are recognizable to those of us in a certain age group, those of us who can still recall an era long consigned to the great dustbins of history, the blue hills of memory. And the spires and farms? Out here they are everywhere to be found, both figuratively and literally, church steeples high above newly budding treetops dotting the landscape waiting for Easter, and all of our farms, small and large, remaining everywhere. Speaking of Easter, I've been listening to portions of G.F. Handel's extraordinary oratorio Messiah, music written to be performed and sung at Easter, not Christmas. Not sure why that changed. It was first performed in Dublin, Ireland in 1742 at Easter. More than 270 years after Messiah debuted, I was fortunate enough to be in the front row for a wonderful, moving, full orchestra, chorus, performance of the oratorio, where it all took place in Dublin. I cried. Let us bring it back to Easter. Last night, coyotes were active again, keening and yipping long after dark. They reside in and around the bluffs below my house, bluffs I've never dared to explore, as it's the province of wild creatures, not a place where we humans should be poking around. The night before, I again listened to a barred owl, a beautiful bird whose call is nothing short of Shakespearean, not iambic pentameter, but two measures, each containing four beats. Bird lovers who describe the call as, "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you?" I suppose that's a simple way to remember it. However, it feels like a bit more creativity might be in order, something more literary for such a grand being. And so April lies ahead, a yawning, unpredictable expanse of time begun by celebrating fools and following in a week by the viewing of a solar eclipse, which the ancients must have found to be terrifying, thinking the world was coming to an end, or that at the very least they were being warned about something, perhaps an accounting of their sins. And you wonder how a merchant a couple of thousand years ago felt when he stepped into the street as an eclipse took place. Did he think about the passage of his own life, whether he had done right by others before the end came and took him? Or did he simply lie awake in his bed that night trying to sort it all out, eventually letting it go? And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 31st, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Faljuto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.